The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library. My name is Johanna Rosen, and I'm honored to be here from the Mill Creek Farm in West Philadelphia to introduce tonight's speaker, Novella Carpenter. If you'd like to learn more about the Mill Creek Farm, there are flyers on the information table outside. Before we get started, please take a moment to turn off your cell phones. Thank you. I'd like to invite you to join Ms. Carpenter in the lobby after the program, where she will be signing copies of her book. Novella Carpenter grew up in rural Idaho and Washington State. She went to University of Washington in Seattle, where she majored in biology and English. She later studied under Michael Pollan at Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism. She's had many odd jobs, including assassin bug handler, book editor, media projectionist, hamster oocyte collector, and most recently, journalist. Her writing has appeared in Salon.com, Saveur.com, SFGate.com, and Mother Jones. Novella has reimagined the American agrarian dream in an abandoned lot in Oakland, California, in a neighborhood known as Ghost Town. It all started with honeybees and a few chickens, then some turkeys, until she created an urban homestead, raising fruits, vegetables, and even pigs and goats. She has been cultivating her farm in the city for over 10 years now, and her neighbors still think she's crazy. Novella chronicles her adventures in her critically acclaimed memoir, Farm City, The Education of an Urban Farmer. Her memoir spreads the gospel of homegrown food and the empowerment it brings. It has been featured on best book lists from Oprah to the New York Times and was recently released in paperback. Please join me in welcoming Novella Carpenter to the Free Library.
Thank you. Thanks, Joe. That's really a lovely introduction. Thank you so much. I had the chance to go and see Joe's farm today. After I got off the plane, I was in Boston last night, and so I was lucky enough to get a tour by Ryan from Greensgrove, and he picked me up, and we just wandered around and looked at all the different urban farms. And I can say without lying at all, well, you guys have an amazing urban farming scene, and it rules. And yeah, it's amazing. And, like, the stuff that's going on is just, I mean, I was, like, taking notes and, like, taking photos. I'm like, I can steal this idea and bring it back with me to Oakland. And that's part of the great thing about being on book tour is I get to see these things. Just abandon my animals and then come out on tour. the one thing that I do a lot of is animal husbandry in Oakland, so I guess that's what's different. And I hope by the end of this talk, you guys are going to run out to your city council person and just demand to raise turkeys or pigs or whatever you want. Or maybe you'll be so horrified you won't even want to even think about that. Witness X number A, you know, exhibit A. So this is a picture of me with my two pigs. The thing that disturbs me the most, I think, of this photo is me wearing flip-flops. That is really scary. That says something about the state of my mind. So this was taken back. It was 2007, and I had finished. These pigs were just about ready to go to slaughter. I had finished my work with them, and in many ways, this photo I showed to people as kind of proof. When people ask me, like, well, what, you're an urban farmer, so you grow, like, some lettuce or something? And then I'm like, actually, no, I have pigs. And then they look at the photo, and they're sort of like, yeah. And then they're like, she's crazy. This was kind of, in a way, a little bit of hitting bottom as well. I wasn't completely sane at this point of my life, partially because the pigs had been so much work. to raise. So if this is me at the bottom, I'm just going to start at the beginning, and then we'll come to this bottom point again. This is my farm. It's in Oakland, California, which is just across the bridge from San Francisco. It's a population of about 500,000, 600,000. And when I show people this slide, there's, just to show it's just urban, it's, near highways and BART tracks and subway and all that stuff. And it's not that big, huge green spot. I wish it were, but it's not. It's where the tip of the arrow is. It's a tenth of an acre lot. And my boyfriend and I, when we first moved in, it looked like this. It was just an abandoned lot next to an apartment building. And I noticed that you guys have many of these things here in Philly as well. And so I did what everyone else wants to do, which is, cut down the weeds and start farming on it. The person in this picture is actually my friend Lana, who is a character in my book. And she always introduces herself by saying, "Lana, anal spelled backward," which sort of says a lot about her. She's a very charismatic and theatrical person. She had a speakeasy just down the street from the farm, and we had a lot of fun together. And then you can see that there's an abandoned building across the way there in that brick. That brick building is a still abandoned building. We started and started building raising vegetables. This is the farm now. I like this picture. I hardly ever take pictures of the farm. This is probably taken a year ago because I like the cops in the picture. There was some sort of drug bust or something like that going on. So that's when I get the camera out. That's when it's like time to take some photos. And so you can see it's pretty ramshackle, partially because it's a squatted lot. We didn't ask permission to start growing food on the lot, and so we just sort of went for it. And also we used just found objects, so we didn't want to spend a lot of money. There was a sense of not wanting to invest a huge amount of money in building it. So that's what it looks like. One of the things that I did when I first started down the path to becoming an urban farmer is I started keeping bees. And I call bees the urban farming gateway animal because they're sort of the thing. And I saw that there were bees at many of the places where I stopped by. And partially they're the greatest piece of livestock you can have because you can go on vacation. You can just leave them. And they're just busy doing their thing, and they don't care what you're up to. Whereas my goats are kind of pissed at me right now. So that's a great thing about beekeeping, as well as the honey and the better pollination. I've noticed in the garden when I have bees, the fruit trees tend to flower more. I don't know how it must be some woo-woo thing, but somehow they know. And so beekeeping has been a really wonderful thing for me. And I think that if all the things that I do in terms of livestock, bees will always be right up there as one of my favorite things. This is kind of what happened with my brain is I had raised chickens and bees in Seattle before I moved to Oakland. So, of course, we needed to have chickens and bees in Oakland. When I was making my order, I also ordered some meat birds. So there's chickens in there. These are not actually the one with the little pimple on its head, the sort of reddish-colored one off to the left there, that's the turkey poult, they are totally like chicks on acid. They're very slow-moving and sort of like, whoa! So they were really interesting to keep. And I'm just going to read a little section of the book so you can kind of get into my, what I was thinking when I started ordering chicks through the mail. As I fiddled with the door to our apartment, the new box of fowl tucked under my arm, I recognized that I was descending deeper into the realm of the underground economy. Now that I had been in California for a few years, I felt ready for what seemed like the next logical progression, something I had never dared in the soggy Northwest, meat birds. I felt a bit nuts, yes, but I also felt great. People move to California to reinvent themselves. They give themselves new names. They go to yoga. Pretty soon they take up surfing or Thai kickboxing or astral healing or witch camp. It's true what they say, California, the land of fruits and nuts. In Northern California, one is encouraged to raise his freak flag proudly and often. Now I was taking it to the next level. Some might say I had been swept up by the Bay Area's mantra, repeated ad nauseum, to eat fresh, local, free-range critters. At farmers' markets in the Bay Area, and there's one every day, it isn't uncommon to overhear farmers chatting with consumers about how the steer from which their steaks were harvested had been fed, where their stewing hens ranged, and the view from the sheep pen that housed the lamb that was now ground up and laid out on a table decorated with nasturtium blossoms. Prices correspond with quality of meat, and Alice Waters assures us that only the best ingredients will make the best meals. But as a poor scrounger with three low-paying jobs and no health insurance, I usually couldn't afford the good stuff. Since I liked eating quality meat and have always had more skill than money, I decided to take matters into my own hands. One night, after living in our apartment for a few years, I clicked my mouse over various meat bird packages offered by Murray McMurray. They were a hatchery that sold day-old ducks, quail, pheasant, turkeys, and geese. They also sold bargain-price combos, the barnyard combo, the fancy duck package, the turkey assortment. These packages, I had thought, might offer a way to eat quality meat without breaking the bank. But I had never killed anything before. Blithely ignoring this minor detail, I settled on the homesteader's delight, which was two turkeys, 10 chickens, two geese, and two ducks for only $42. I bought my poultry package with the click of a mouse and paid for it with a credit card. It was only after the post office delivered the box that I realized that one can't just buy a farm animal like a book or a CD. What I now held in my hands was going to involve a lot of hard work. So then I go on, I install the birds under a brooder, which is this light in a box. And my boyfriend wanders out and is like, what the hell is she doing? The baby birds were home, warm and safe. The chicks scratched at their yellow feed, just like our big chickens out back did. Sometimes they would stop mid-scratch and, feeling the warmth of the brooder light, fall asleep while standing up. The puffy gray goslings curled their necks around the yellow sleeping ducklings. A Hallmark card had exploded in my living room. I mean, am I right? Isn't that cute? Oh, wait. Look, I have a cute... Look at that. Oh, it's so cute. I just want to die. I called my mom. A brooder box full of fowl was something that woman could appreciate. She had once been a hippie homesteader in Idaho. Listen to this, I said, and held the phone near the brooder box. 100 little peeps. Oh, my God, she said. 2 turkeys, 2 ducks, 2 geese, and 10 chickens, I crowed. I watched the chicks and poults moving around the brooder, pooping and scratching. Turkeys, do you remember Tommy Turkey, she asked. I didn't, but the photo in our family album had stuck with me, my older sister, Rihanna, in a saggy cloth diaper, being chased by the advancing figure of a giant white turkey, Tommy. My mom told us about Tommy every time we got out the old photo album from the ranch days. Well, he would chase you, and he was mean as hell. I looked out the window while my mom described the smokehouse she and my dad had built. My boyfriend Bill had made it downstairs. He was out front tinkering with us with our car. His legs peeked out from underneath our dilapidated Mercedes as he rolled around amid the street's numerous Swisher Sweet cigar butts. I had warned him about my meat bird purchase, and he had been excited about the prospect of homegrown meat. But now that he had seen the baby chicks, fragile, tiny, he seemed a bit skeptical. Tommy grew to be an enormous size, my mom was saying, and as back-to-the-land hippies, she and my dad had been very pleased. They didn't encounter any predator problems that year, and butchering him was a cinch. But disaster did hit. The smokehouse burned to the ground while they were smoking the turkey. Oh, no, I groaned. Life was like that, she said glumly. I felt sorry for her. My mom's stories usually involve some heroic hippie farm action. I hadn't heard this part of the story before, but I knew that bad things had happened. Her voice brightened. Even though the smokehouse burned down, we did manage to salvage the turkey. What do you mean? I asked. Well, we dug through the charred wood, and there it was, a perfectly cooked turkey. I brushed off all the cinders and served him for dinner. She paused and smacked her lips. It was the best turkey I've ever had, she declared. We said our goodbyes, and I hung up the phone. I glanced into the cozy chick brooder. Their fuzzy bodies slumbered on snatches of color ads for watches. I had to remind myself that though they were cute, these baby birds would eventually become my dinner. Thanksgiving, in particular, was going to be intense. I imagined the killing scene, a butcher block, an axe, three giant Tommy turkeys I had known since Polthood. I wasn't sure I could bring myself to do it. But the conversation with my mom left me emboldened for my foray into killing and eating animals I had raised myself. This urge was clearly part of my cultural DNA. I wondered if this would prove I could have it both ways, to sop up the cultural delights of the city while simultaneously raising my own food. In retrospect, though, I wonder why I thought my experience would be any less disastrous than my parents'. So here's, I just go through, like, you know, the reasons for keeping chickens, which is great eggs. And you can see I'm the total anti-Martha Stewart. I take pictures of the eggs with the poop on it. And that big, huge one is actually a turkey egg. I had this whole fantasy about having turkeys raising their own young. Anyway, it didn't work out. But turkey sex is kind of fun to watch. Here is, these are bourbon. This is a bourbon red, the one in the front. And then in the back is a royal palm. And what I did is I started raising these heritage breed turkeys. And my first round was this turkey, Harold and Maude. This is Archie and Edith. So I was really original with the naming. But they were great turkeys. However, when I did the math, I figured out that I spent about $100 to raise each of the turkeys for Thanksgiving, which makes no sense at all. Like, I could have just bought a really great turkey from a farmer who knows what they're doing. And so I thought, well, that didn't work out. So then I started to think about what meat animal is really sustainable. And I came across a friend that was raising rabbits, and she sort of taught me what she knew. And I started raising rabbits. And when I look at this slide, I sort of am like, look how cute those little tiny bunnies are. And am I a monster? But then I just remember back in the day, this is my sister and myself, and we're holding, there's our rabbits. So my parents totally raised meat rabbits as back to the land hippies. It was one of the most easy ways for them to acquire protein on the farm in Idaho. And we loved it. It was like, we fried rabbit. That was like good stuff. In a lot of ways, going back to raising meat rabbits was sort of coming full circle for me, experiencing some of the same things that my mom did. Okay, so here's where it went bad. Like I was saying, with the turkeys, they're really expensive. And the rabbits could have been expensive as well. If you feed them a lot of pellets, it can just be add up. And so one of the things my boyfriend and I started to do was we were in Chinatown one night. This is before we had the pigs. And we were drunk. And we opened up the compost, you know, recycling bin that they have out on the sidewalk there. And we're like, holy crap, look at all this stuff. Bok choy, all these things that rabbits would love. And then occasionally we would open up a dumpster, you know, lid, and it would be disgusting. Like, what? Just all kinds of gnarly chow mein and stuff. And then we realized, you know who would like that chow mein? That guy right there, Piggy. And so I found myself at a swine auction in Mendocino County. How many of you have been to a swine auction? Has anyone here? Okay, a couple of you. It rules. Am I wrong? It's so cool. It's so exciting. What they do, the one I went to was a 4-H auction. And so it was like these little kids. So imagine little kids plus this pig and little pigs just like it in a ring chasing pigs around while an auctioneer in that fast, you know, 152 thing yells out numbers and then you're waving a flag trying to buy the pigs. I mean, that is a recipe for heaven. And it was a great date that Bill and I went on. Now, we were also of the type of, we were city people. And so we brought a station wagon to load up our pigs. And the whole town watched us. Because most people had the good sense to have a pickup truck. And so we just put them in a crate in the back, and then we were like, bye. And people are like, oh, God. And the odor from these pigs was insane. And they were little, tiny piglets who were in clean straw. They were just really smelly. There was a long drive home, let's just say that. But here's, and I'm, oh, so I'm just going to read a little part about what we're thinking about with the pigs. Back in the ghetto, I herded the pigs into their new home. It was just getting dark. The air felt heavy, but it wasn't raining. That morning, in anticipation of the piglets, I had enhanced the chicken area with a bucket filled with water and a feeding trough made from the same metal wash tub I had once used to dip and pluck my turkey, Harold. I had also tipped a barrel sideways with the idea that they would sleep in it. Safely behind the closed gates of their yard, the pigs seemed mildly curious, but far from geniuses stomping out Morse code with their cloven feet, thank God. They ran around kicking up sawdust, as they had in the ring a few hours ago. The pigs were both red Duroks. Duroks, sometimes called Jersey Reds, are known for quality fat production. These pigs had, even at their young age, the classic arched backs that one often sees in profile of meat company labels. They had curly tails, but it was not a tight curl, and I noticed later that they wagged them when they were happy with a certain food item, or the sun was shining just right, or scratching their backs with a stick. The tails then did convey emotion. As they checked out their surroundings, they made quiet grunting sounds. I had wondered if the city's noises, a police helicopter circling the hood, someone yelling at the junkyard dogs next door, would be a shock to their system. They had, after all, lived in deep country, all trees and pasture. But if they were disturbed by the city's smells and sounds, they made no sign of it. Pigs, I was glad to see, were not very sensitive. We looked at them, newly installed in their pen, as they nosed around. They stood in front of their gate and smiled up at us expectantly. We read their minds. Where's the pig chow? On cue, we jumped in the car and raced over to Chinatown. That night, for the first time ever, Bill and I threw open the dumpsters with our hearts and minds. Will they eat, we wondered, these soggy pieces of Chinese donut? I discovered yes. These chunks of leftover duck that includes the duck head? Yes. Wontons and dumplings covered with somehow frosting? Yes. Bill and I anxiously unloaded our two buckets of slop from the car. We had never collected such a disgusting assortment of salty and sweet meat and vegetable. But pigs, I had heard, were omnivorous, and so we were respecting that. We walked through the gate to the backyard and were greeted by two grunts, one deep and demanding, the other soft, questioning. I hefted a bucket full of Chinatown into the metal washtub trough. The pigs began feeding before the second bucket was empty, so I ended up pouring a load of grapes and wontons over their heads and watched it bounce off their shoulders and land on the ground. Their focus was amazing. While they ate, the pigs let out small sighs of approval. Their lip smacking was audible. At times, they would stop chewing and simply suck up the juices from the trough through their nostrils. They were the best dinner guests ever. The pigs stopped eating for a moment and gazed up at us. Their mouths moved continuously. Their chins were smeared with frosting and grease. Now that I thought of it, these pigs had probably never had food like this before. They probably only had their mother's milk, a few handfuls of pig chow, and maybe a rotten apple. Now they were eating Chinese, like good urban pigs. So we hit Chinatown regularly. They got huge. They're very happy, but not in a way that made me not want to eat them. We also realized at one point that we couldn't keep going to Chinatown. First of all, it was disgusting for us. I mean, it was just like wontons and frosting. Like, you can't bear that smell for very long. But also because the pigs became like true Bay Area pigs, very discerning. And we began going to only organic restaurants to find their food. At one point, I cooked for the pigs, and that was just, I had to draw the line. I found myself cooking up a pot of slop on my oven, and I just thought, you know, this is just not okay. And I knew, you know, there's so many restaurants and there's so much waste in the city, and this was part of what my experiment in being an urban farmer was all about, was to try to tap into this. And so we began frequenting very high-end restaurant dumpsters. The pigs ate better than we did, let's just say that. And after a night of dumpster diving, it was a delicious smell in our station wagon instead of grossness. And at one of the restaurants we went to, a very fancy Italian restaurant, I was caught in the dumpster, which happened repeatedly. And there's something about getting caught in a dumpster that's very shaming. And it was always some fancy dressed man who smelled really good, and I did not smell good. And I'm like throwing like buckets, you know, chickens into buckets and stuff. Like, I appear crazy. And so instead of lying, I would always tell them, I have two pigs, okay? I have big problems. You're not going to stop me from getting this food. And one of the guys who found me in the dumpster said, oh, well, you should talk to Chris, who is a butcher here at this restaurant. And I was like, really? And he's like, yeah, he's this amazing, you know, he knows all about salumi and all this stuff. So I finally get up the courage to go to the restaurant, partially because at this point I was desperate. If you have two pigs in your hands and you have no idea what you're going to do with the meat upon slaughter, you're in big trouble. And this was the situation that I found myself in. I don't have a freezer. I had been telling people, you know, oh, I'm going to make, you know, dry cure it. You know, it's going to be great bacon. Vaguely having no idea how to do any of this stuff. So in a desperate move, I went to this restaurant, Ecolo Restaurant, and asked to talk to the chef. I had two pigs. That was the message to send to him. And he came out, and I went to the front of the restaurant. I kind of put on some cleaner clothes. We got to talking, and he was just lovely. And the first thing I said to him was, like, great dumpster. I love it. I love what you're doing with the dumpster, which is a great way to ingratiate yourself to any restaurateur. He, after a while, you know, he kind of warmed up to me, and we struck a deal, a bargain, in exchange for one of the biggest pig legs. He would teach me how to make, he would teach me all his secrets about how to make salumi. And I was like, great, total good deal. And so I started doing this apprenticeship with him. So I learned how to make salamis. I learned how to make coppa and pancetta. He even gave me printouts of these sausage recipes, like secret guarded recipes. I have lost them, of course, being me. But and then when it came time to process our pigs, he was amazing. I brought the pigs down. I'm just going to, this might disturb you. I will move it. If anyone says, please move it, I'll do that. Is anyone okay? I know. But don't they look a little bit optimistic? I mean, just slightly. Like, you have to remember, these pigs were eating the best food ever. At the end, we decided to finish them on something. So we decided on peaches, because it was peach season. And so these pigs ate peaches and ricotta for, like, you know, a week before we took them to slaughter. So I think in this picture, their expression is sort of like, what next? Like, what amazing food are we going to have now? So anyway, and part of why I have the heads is I'm not like a Jeffrey Dahmer type, but because Chris was really adamant about, you know, honoring the animal, and part of honoring the animal is using the entire thing, including the head. And he had this amazing recipe for this head cheese that he made. And so we cooked the heads, and it was this, you know, became this gooey mess with, like, yummy chunks of meat in it. And we made this beautiful soppressata, which he then served to his patrons, which I love. People said they could taste the peaches in there. So that was kind of interesting. And then we made all the other things. We made salami and coppa and pancetta. One of the pigs I had butchered by a traditional butcher. So they just wrapped everything into paper. And then with Chris, it was all just sort of in the open. It was this beautiful thing, especially making the prosciutto. You just take the leg and just rub it with salt until it starts to because you start to have this feeling from it. And it's very erotic in a way. You're like rubbing this pig's butt, you know? It's just really, it's really amazing. And that is prosciutto. And Chris was telling me when we were doing it, I was like, what do you, in Italy, what do you do while you're like rubbing these pig's butts? And he's like, oh, we just make a lot of dirty jokes. I just thought that was really interesting. And so anyway, it turned out great. When my book came out, I wrote the book after the pigs. That's sort of how the book ends. Coincidentally, it takes 18 months for prosciutto to become prosciutto. It has to hang and cure. And it takes that long for a book to be published as well. And so we had a book party, and Chris served the prosciutto. And he's so funny because, I was very nervous. I had raised the pigs for 6 months. The prosciutto had been hanging out for 18 months. It had been so much work. And the night of the book party, Chris had rented this amazing Burkle. It's like a slicer. It would slice the prosciutto so thin you could read a newspaper through it. And, you know, he had pulled out all the stops. The restaurant, this was when the recession had started. The restaurant was going under. He kept it open just for me, which was just amazing. And he was like, Novella, I'm going to go, you know, get the prosciutto ready. They cut the prosciutto into different pieces, and each one of them has a different name, and then they slice it using the Burkle. And so he goes into a back room, and he doesn't come out for a while, so I go find him. And he looks up at me, and he's sitting in this room, and he's got the pieces of prosciutto, and he's like, it's awful. And I said, no. Like, I'm just like, the wind has been taken out of me. And then he's like, I'm just fucking with you. He's like, it's the best prosciutto I've ever had. Anyway, he's a total restaurateur, so of course he said that. And it was really good. And for me, it was the best prosciutto I've ever had. I think it was the only prosciutto I could really afford. So that was great. However, I started to feel a little bit like the witch in Hansel and Gretel, where I'm always like, is that one ready to eat? You know, I just felt like I was eating everything. And so I had a little bit of a crisis. And there was more space. The pigs were gone. And I thought, what would make me feel good about myself? And I decided goats. And I had researched it a lot. I had tried to start a goat collective, all this stuff. That didn't work out. Then I found these Nigerian dwarf goats, which are these little tiny 21-inch goats. And so I decided to start raising them. This is Orla. She was born on the farm. She's a little... Here's some pictures of her. That's her sister, Foxy. It's kind of fun. The names are fun. You can give them, like, porn star names. And BB here, that's the mom. And anyway, so the goats have been really great. And also because I can make cheese. So that's been a wonderful experiment for me, and it's been great. And the other thing that's great about goats is because they're dairy animals, you have to keep them freshened, which means you just need to breed them and keep them in milk. So there's often babies. So one of the things that I've done is started to sell the offspring, the kids, especially the does. So this friend of mine came over who lives about 10 blocks from me. This is Abene Ramsey. She's now my business partner. This is one of Orla's offspring. So they just keep reproducing, and they go off. And you send them off to different places, and then they come back to you pretty much. So Abene and I are now running a little goat dairy up in San Lorenzo, which is outside of Oakland a little bit, just a little bit more space. And we're also raising more rabbits out there in this farm area. So the thing that's amazing about goats is it opens up. I have people come visit all the time who want to see the goats. There's a man who came the other day who's from Nigeria, and he wanted to see the goats because they're Nigerian dwarf goats. And he came in, he's like, it's just like home. There's like, you know, because the goats run up and down the back stairs. So it's very exciting back there. So that's really made me happy. I think a lot of people ask about, this probably isn't your guys' problem here. You have access to land, but for a lot of people, it's hard. They live in an apartment, or their neighbors are persnickety and they don't want chickens next to them. And so I like to show this slide. This is my friend Patrick, and his chickens that he has, he owns collectively with a group of people in Portland, Oregon, just as a model for different ways of raising livestock. I think it's 10 different families raise the chickens. They have like 25 chickens. They split duties in terms of feed and cleaning out the coop and all that stuff. So I think that's been really great. And then, you know, a lot of people will be like, oh, pioneering this newfangled urban farming. And so, you know, of course, no, we know it's been going on for years. And I wonder, you know, and it's sort of happening with Michelle Obama. And this is actually the picture of the building is Town Hall in or City Hall in San Francisco, where they installed a Victory Garden into the main area. And so there's a slight movement toward this happening. And, you know, I think that it's one of those things that we're just going to see more and more of as people become more interested in urban farming and food security issues. This is a funny little book, The Integral Urban House. It's written in the 70s, and it was for people who, unlike my parents, who wanted to stay in the city and fight the good fight. And so this is an amazing house in West Berkeley, and they have solar panels, they have aquaponics, it's, you know, they have a composting toilet. So these things have been around for a really long time. There's no new ideas, really. It's just sort of how we are grabbing them and running with them. And then this is an example of the Black Panthers. They are still around in Oakland and Berkeley, and I provided lettuce for their literacy program for a while. And one of the things that I found out that was so interesting that I'd never known is that they had started the free breakfast program and then a free lunch program as well, and that became the model that actually the one that exists now for people in high schools and low-income people who need food in the morning. And I was talking to Melvin Dixon, who's the gentleman holding the scones there, and I was like, yeah, Melvin, you know, everyone's eating junk food now. And he's like, Novella, I used to make tofu and brown rice. You know, I was all about eating healthy. And that was part of the mandate of the Black Panther program, was to give people groceries. They also had relationships with farmers in the general region who would bring food down to put into these bags that were then given to communities. So all of these ideas that we keep rehashing and reinventing have existed before. And I just think it's, for some reason, that gives me a sense of, I feel calm knowing that, because otherwise it just feels too crazy. But if you know you're just part of a history, just another example, another wave, it's very satisfying and relaxing. And then these are just some pictures of various places I've gone to visit. As I've done the tour, like I said, I get to go and see all these different urban farms and get new ideas from people. And everybody does it differently, you know, and it's interesting because I really feel like whatever city you live in, your urban farming really reflects who that city is. And from what I've seen in Philly today, it's a city with an amazing potential, an amazing heart, and some really badass farmers. So I was really, really impressed with all the know-how and stuff you guys did. These are just examples of, because I think what happened is, you know, in the late 90s and early 2000s, people got really involved with nonprofits and setting up nonprofit food justice systems. And as I've been traveling around, and I saw this today at Greensgrow, people are starting to look at more of a model, like a business model, to make money growing food. And these are just two examples. Brooklyn Grange, which is rooftop gardens in Brooklyn. If you guys have been out to the Brooklyn Kitchen, has a, I think it's 6,000 square foot garden. And it's beautiful. And they also have now, I think it's an acre on a big, huge, huge rooftop in Queens. And these things, and also Little City Gardens, which is in San Francisco, which is two women that do microgreen business. And they're really showing this way, and Greensgrow as well is really showing this way that urban farming, it doesn't just have to be this like weird little niche hobby that people are doing. There is a way to actually make money at it using various wily methods of living in the city. The Brooklyn Grange people are interesting because they have a lot of relationships with restaurants within the city limits. And because they're growing on rooftops, they don't have problems with the leaded soil or contaminated soil. And also they were not affected by last year's late blight with the blight with the tomatoes. because they were like up, 10 stories, so they never really got the spores up there. And I thought that was really interesting. So there's all these different ways to do it. Everybody has a different idea. None of them are right or wrong. It's just how you're going to do it in your with your system and your economics and the people who are working with you and all of that. And I've just been really, it's been great to see all this stuff unfold, and I just feel just honored to be here. So there you go. Thank you. So we're going to take questions, I think, and I think people are going to have microphones wandering around. So if you have a question, raise your hand. Hey. Anybody? Oh, yep, that guy right there. Mm-hmm. Oops, sorry. That lady right there.
Hi. I was just wondering if your farm is still threatened by development, and also if you visited the Weaver's Way farm yet.
Oh, I know. I didn't go there. Dang it.
You should come before you
crap.
Leave.
Crap. I know. This is like the horrible thing about being on tour is like you just never get to go to all the places that you want to. I really do. I know. I've heard about that place. My farm is constantly threatened because I'm a squatter, and I know that other people here have that experience. And so a lot of it just has to do with economics. So when the recession hit, I was like, yeah, this rules. And so I was really happy about it. And what happens in California, maybe not, I don't know, it's probably the same here, is that people land bank. And so they buy lots and because they have money to start with, and then they sit on them until they become valuable. And in the instance of my lot, it was sold. It went up for sale. And they sold it for $300,000. And then the woman who bought the lot, this was at the end of 2007, and then the housing market crumbled. Like, there was a whole boom bust in California that was really intense. And all of a sudden, land values plummeted. So she was left kind of holding the bag, you know. She came to my place one day. I was, like, hanging out with some friends out front. And she came by, and she was like, whose garden is this? And I was like, it's mine. Do you want a tour? I'm like taking her around, showing her stuff. She's like, because I just bought this lot. And then I'm like, oh, God. And then I just like, I always have the same fantasy, which is like the bulldozers come in and it's all over, and the trees are crying. And, I try to think like, how will I dig up that lime tree that's 7 years old now, But she was like, oh, it's okay. I know the housing crisis is horrible for me. So I want to build condos. That's my dream. And but I can't do it right now because I can't get any funding. And, there's this abandoned giant brick building across the street that's abandoned. And so it's probably not going to happen. So I've been really lucky to be saved by bad economic times, I guess. and someday I need to find a bunch of a giant suitcase full of money so I can buy a lot and not have to worry about it. Well, thanks for the question.
First, a piece of trivia. I read someplace that goats were the second domesticated animal after dogs.
Yeah,
I don't know if that's true or not. But it's my understanding that at one time, you could not keep just one animal. One animal was illegal in the city of Philadelphia, and that was pigs.
Oh, wow.
And now all these domestic animals are illegal to keep. You can't keep ducks, roosters, cows. Horses, I think, are the only other farm animal that you can keep.
Right.
So I'm wondering if anybody else here knows anything different. The other thing I will mention, I'm astounded how many people have come to this.
Me too.
And how many of them are from Philadelphia? Maybe they're from the suburbs and farming. I don't know.
What I've heard today is that it's illegal unless you're a nonprofit with an educational sort of mandate in the city of Philadelphia to raise any animal, any livestock. And so I know Greensboro has some chickens, like demo chickens. But from my experience is that basically those laws, and maybe I'm wrong, maybe Philadelphia has a really tight legal system, is that much like Oakland, that you can pretty much do whatever you want as long as your neighbors aren't upset with you. So if you approached your neighbors or had a relationship such that you could propose this idea and they would not report you, then you might be able to get away with it. See, I'm all about, you know, not asking for permission and just sort of going for it. But I also, and I did hear about the horses here, and that makes me kind of want to move here. Like, I would love to, I mean, I have this fantasy of, like, riding a mule down the MLK or something. I would love that. But I think horses are banned in Oakland. So it's like we have this, like, yin and yang thing. It's like the opposite, opposite world here. Because in Oakland, anything is legal except roosters. That's the one banned animal. So you can really just go crazy. Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the stuff that you're actually making money growing and the stuff that is not working for you on, like, the small scale that you're doing stuff.
Yeah, cash crops. Well, I was a marijuana grower in Seattle, and that made mad money. The problem with that is that it's a monoculture. And, like, and pot growers never talk about that. They never talk about how, like, this is just the same thing over and over and over again. How boring. But I've noticed that people make money selling microgreens. The little city farms, that's what they're doing. Partially because every restaurant needs, when they serve a sandwich, to have a little cute salad green mix there on the side. And they grow amazing stuff that's, I mean, they're like, they're like angels out there with their little scissors, just cutting like the smallest little miner's lettuce. You know what I mean? And I don't know if it's going to eventually drive them crazy, because it would drive me crazy. The other thing that you can make money at is rabbits, raising meat rabbits. There's a huge demand. And in America, there's not rules so much in terms of with the federal government about their care and slaughter. And so you can actually do home slaughter, which is great for a small-scale farmer. I mean, what are you going to do, take them up to the slaughterhouse and pay some guy $5 each to kill them? I mean, your profit margin is gone. And the other thing I've noticed is bees, raising bees for honey. And then you could also do some pollination services. That's generally a way to make money. But money losers are goats. I know only too well. And, you know, chickens, it's hard to sell eggs. It's hard to, you know, make money unless you're really pasturing them in some way where you're hardly feeding them any pelleted food. I've calculated that if I sold my eggs, I would have to charge 50 cents an egg. And that's just so freaking expensive, you know? And I just feel bad about that. So that's what I've noticed. Mm-hmm. Oh, he's still there with the hat.
Are you, with your experience, are you aware of any business models that bring slaughtered meat directly to restaurants, higher quality grass-fed cattle? Obviously, with your pigs, there was indication given that the prosciutto that you guys produced was superior maybe to some of the markets. Is there possibly a demand where someone could supply directly to restaurants, and do you know of any business models or people that are doing that? Maybe there's something that prohibits that.
Yeah, there's not, because the problem with restaurants is that they will shut you down if they find out you're buying non-USDA stamped meat. However, that doesn't mean it doesn't happen. People who are willing to do that route, you know, kind of the underground economy, it happens a lot. With rabbits, there's no USDA stamp. I was actually... It's that they have a facility that there where a USDA agent stands there all day and makes sure that they're doing everything right, which is kind of total BS because they're not doing everything right there. And I had a hilarious thing happen. What was horrible at the time where I came home and there was a card on my doorstep, and it was from the federal USDA investigators. And it was a very 1984 moment because they also went out to my other farm in San Lorenzo where I'm raising the rabbits. And they came to my house and they showed me their IDs and everything. It was like really intense. And then we came upstairs and we hung out and they were basically like showing me pictures of me showing, I teach classes a lot about slaughtering animals, slaughtering turkeys or chickens or rabbits. And they showed me pictures, and they're like, well, what is this? What exactly? And I'm like, well, you know, I don't know. It was for home consumption. These are just classes, and then, you know, I end up eating the meat. It's not sold. And then they were like, okay. And then we sort of talked about rabbits a little bit, and I was like, well, you guys don't, you know, you don't have a facility that, or you don't have a requirement for inspection for rabbits. And they were like, yes, but we have a voluntary program where you can take your rabbits in to get slaughtered at the slaughterhouse. And I'm just looking at them like, oh my God, thank you. You know, that's great. And I just wonder if these people have ever been to a slaughterhouse like that. And then I was talking to a woman who raises chickens for meat, and she's like, you can't believe it. You can't believe what goes on in there. It's total pandemonium, and people are just there. It's just disgusting. So for me, I would much rather do it at home. But then, of course, it's hard to sell to restaurants. So I have done a little bit. I hope they're not listening. A little direct marketing, let's just say. Oh yeah, there's definitely that sense. There's definitely that sense. Well, right, and why are they coming after me? It was just totally weird, you know? I guess. So I don't know of any good models. And they're like, and they're like that with wild meat, too. You know, you can't sell venison, so then you have to buy farm venison if you're going to sell it at a butcher shop. So it's stifling. It's like that whole Joel Salatin thing, like everything I want to do is illegal. And I used to be that, you know, that libertarian, and now I'm like, hell yeah, you know? So... it's unfortunate.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Anything else? No other? Okay, yeah.
Hi.
Hey.
Thanks for coming. You mentioned something about teaching classes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad that you mentioned education, because I lived in Oakland for a little while, and
Cool.
You look like you're kind of near Lazier Elementary. Are you kind
no,
of
I don't know that one. What's the cross street?
It's by the Fruitvale BART station.
Oh, yeah, that's East Oakland. Yeah.
It's pretty close to there. And the Parker Elementary Way on the other side.
Uh-huh.
Do you work at all in the schools with your education programs,
you know,
or is it mostly teaching people that raise their own stuff?
It's usually teaching people who are raising their own stuff. It's usually adults. But I have had a couple student groups come out because I'll get, you know, lots of emails, and people will be like, please, can I bring my kids? And it's been with mixed results. Partially because I'm on a squat lot. I mean, what are the liability issues? I have no idea. And then one time these kids were coming. They're coming. They all got off the bus, and one of my neighbors was like, what is this, a ghetto tour? You know? And then they're like, we're here to see the farm. And then he's like, oh, okay, come on. You know, it's just like, what next, you know? And so it kind of disrupts things a little bit too much, and so I'm trying to keep it to a minimum. But also it's mostly the liability that I worry about. Like, what if someone gets headbutted by my goat, you know? And then I'm like, oh, crap, brain damage or whatever. You know, I just don't want to be responsible for that. And in terms of going to schools, I guess I'd go. I guess I'd go for sure. Yeah, yeah. They just haven't really asked me. I think they're worried about swearing. Oh, yeah. There you go.
In terms of education, how did you learn
everything? Oh, wait. They're podcasting it, so you have to speak in the microphone. Sorry.
How did you learn everything that you know about animal husbandry? And also, what other crops do you grow other than just the animals?
Yeah. I learned through trial and error, and also reading this amazing book called The Encyclopedia of Country Living by Carla Emery. And it's this giant book, and she was a back-to-the-lander actually in Idaho. And it's a really funny book, and I actually worked for the publishing company that used to print that book. And I would sit there in my office in downtown Seattle and drink my latte and laugh my ass off, because there would be pictures of, like, here's where you kill a pig. It'll be like a cartoon picture of a pig. And then when I actually had the pigs, I looked at that illustration kind of a lot. You know, I was just like, oh my God, could I do it? And so I really learned through that. I learned over the years I've traveled, and so I've gone to France, and they have a very peasant culture where people kill their animals all the time. And so I asked them, how do you kill your animals? How do you kill your rabbits especially? And so I've learned how to do it just by asking them. And I've taken some classes, or, you know, just sort of, you know, randomly you'll have someone will be like, I'm going to show people how to humanely kill a chicken. And so I would go. And now I show people how to humanely kill a chicken. So it's kind of that, you know, just passing the knowledge on, I guess. But yeah, so that's basically how I learned. I didn't, with the goats, you know, I had that whole fantasy of not ever having to deal with the goats in a way that I had to kill one. But of course there are males that are born in the packs, and you can't really keep a male goat. That's another animal that's illegal in Oakland, a male goat, because they smell really bad. And my little goatling, my little buckling, he, Eeyore, he was, at 2 weeks old, he smelled really bad, and then he was humping everything. He was like trying to hump chickens. You know what I mean? Like he was like possessed by a devil. And so I realized I was not going to be able to continue to have Eeyore on the farm. However, Eeyore was adorable. How was I possibly going to kill him? And so, of course, I researched the slaughterhouse, which USDA slaughterhouse can I take him to? And, of course, he's going to have a traumatic trip driving out to Stockton, which is an hour away and all this stuff. And I was just like, God, here we go again. This is horrible. What can I do? And so Bill went to go get me a beer at Brothers Market. And he was, you know, buying his liquor and happened to mention, like, yeah, Novella's, you know, got this goat. And Mosed in the book, there's a whole story of him coming down. Bill, I don't know if this is true, but Bill said, he said, we have a goat. And then all of a sudden it was sort of like a bad Disney movie where people are like, she's got a goat. She's got a goat. And then Moses came down the stairs wearing this like robe, amazing gold robe, and was like, I will kill the goat. Because it turned out that he was a goat farmer in Yemen, for 20 years before he became a liquor store owner in Oakland. And I was kind of like, right, he's going to kill the goat. And the next day he showed up with knives, and he was wearing an amazing outfit. I should have the picture on file so you guys can see it, but he was wearing like, you know, a silk dress shirt and, you know, polyester pants. And he brought his wife and he brought his granddaughter. And I'm like, holy crap, they're bringing the whole family for this. And his wife sang a beautiful song while they killed the animal, which was amazing. And they faced it toward east, and it was a whole intense halal butcher. And it was very fast. It was incredibly fast, and it was over. And then I thought, you know, that's how it should be. You know, this is the ceremony of meat. If you are going to eat meat, is sort of the sacred thing. It's taking a life, and, you know, it's this full cycle and all of that. So I was grateful for that, and that's how, I can't remember how did I start talking about this? I don't even remember. But yeah, so that's what's been going on with me lately. but I can't do it. I can't kill the little goats. They're too cute.
So what percentage of your diet are you eating from your lot? And question two, what do you know about raising sheep?
Mm. Oh, yeah, I remembered her question now. She wanted to know about what else I'm growing besides meat, and then I started just talking about meat all the time. I'm horrible. I grow a lot of greens. Part of what I want to do is feed our neighborhood, and so people are really actually hungry. And so I plant a lot of collard greens and mustard greens and turnip greens, and I'm very satisfied when I look out the window and I see people. There's no organized structure. People just show up and harvest stuff. I sort of feel like I'm squatting on the land, so people should pick it. And that also touches on your question, is how much of the food do I eat that I grow? And I can do 100%. I've done it before. I just did it recently. Usually when I'm feeling a little fat, I'll be like, I'm going to go for it. Although it backfired on me last time because I had a goat in milk. And so my diet became like Chev and like cappuccinos or, you know, it didn't make any sense. But so yeah, I have, and in the book I talk about, I'm going a month where I just eat only stuff that I grow. And it's fine to do that. I think it's a really good exercise, and it really makes you honor, you know, really feel a connection to your food in a intense way. But it also makes you a little bit selfish, and you wouldn't want to share with people as much. And so I think it creates a sort of a, It's kind of like that idea of self-reliance, right? It's like a very American idea. But at the same time, it's kind of bogus, right? We need each other. And so it kind of knocks it off into this way where you're just built this wall around yourself where you're like, I could live, you know, I'm a survivalist, you know? And I, that just became distasteful for me. So I only do that, only try to survive on food I grow myself, like 100%, when I'm feeling fat. But I do. I mean, if I had to put a number on, even about, you know, every single salad or green, I would never order greens at a restaurant, you know. So all the greens and tomatoes, season and all that stuff. So I'd say probably maybe 50%. But I also love living in a city, and cities for me are all about Chinese dumplings, you know. Like I love dumplings, and so I would never give that up, you know. So that's how I do that. In terms of sheep, I have thought about raising sheep. You know that big piece of greenery that was on that photo? I sometimes think about raising sheep out there because they would cut the lawn, and it would be this great thing. They're just like, it's a totally fenced area because it used to be a playground. But I don't know. Then I watched this movie called Sweet Grass, and I was just like, no, I'm not going to do it. They're not very clever. Let's just say that. I need a goat. Goats are smart. You know, you need them to, like, be ready to defend themselves, I guess. I don't know. Yeah. Okay, one more. Is there one more? Oh, hey. No.
Is it working?
Oh, there we go.
I want to thank you, Novella. I want to thank you very much for a couple of things. One is the sheer delight of the image of a homeless man handing you a dollar as you're groping for fish guts.
Thank you.
And the other is a phrase that you used in the book, which will be with me till the end of my life because it's so beautiful. And it has nothing to do with chickens or goats or rabbits or pigs. And I raise all those. I have a little farm. Mm. And I'm also a writer at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Mm. And since I sell my eggs to my coworkers at the paper, I was the obvious candidate to write the review, which was in this past Sunday's paper.
Thank you. That was a great review. Thank you so much.
And when I read one phrase that you wrote, it floored me, and I thought, "This is a poet. This is more than a city farmer. This is a poet." And that is when I was young and healthy and nostalgic for the present. Beautiful.
Thank you. Thank you so much. That is a great way to end the evening. And thank you. I really appreciate it because, you know, you can be a farmer and it's another thing to be a writer. And I really thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.